This is Law and Disorder.
A Law and Disorder exclusive, a talk by Fast Food Nation author Eric Schlosser on prison stats in this country, something that he's been collecting over the past several years in preparation for a new book.
Here at Law and Disorder, we focus a lot on Bagram, Abu Ghraib, and Guantanamo. But we don't want you to forget the prison system in this country that is imprisoning millions and millions of people in harsh conditions.
And we bring you the update on the Palestinian American who went to Israel to give humanitarian aid for Palestinians, was arrested and tortured by the Israelis, came back home only 5 years later to find himself prosecuted by the Bush administration.
The evidence against him, the results of Israeli torture.
Kristen Houlet from Amnesty International joins us to tell us about the latest botched execution.
37 states allow lethal injections, an inhumane way of death.
And we'll also talk with Professor Austin Surratt, co-editor of the book, From Lynch Mobs to the Killing State.
Over 5,000 people were lynched since the end of the Civil War. And legal lynching, the death penalty, which was brought back in 1976, has claimed the lives of another 985 people.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
We turn now to the second part of the speech on the U.S. prison system given by Fast Food Nation author Eric Schlosser. We've covered in depth on Law and Disorder the U.S.-run prison industry abroad, from Guantanamo Bay Prison, Cuba, Bagram Prison in Afghanistan, and Abu Ghraib in Iraq. These are the exports of one of the most highly profitable businesses in the United States. The prison industrial complex in this country has reached record-breaking occupancy. Nearly 2.1 million Americans are behind bars, the majority of them nonviolent offenders who are usually poor, who may have substance abuse problems, and many of whom are mentally ill. This, according to exhaustive research by author Eric Schlosser, who spoke at Blue Stockings Bookstore in New York about his compendium on the American prison system. Law and Disorder caught up with Eric during this talk, and we listened to the second part of his one-hour speech. In his talk, he warns our society of the perils of a profit-driven penal system and backs his research with well-documented facts and staggering statistics. Let's take a listen.
The prison industrial complex, as I see it, isn't just this political and bureaucratic and economic incentive. One other economic incentive is the rural areas. That now the only form of rural development is prison building. So you have this perverse system where the Latinos and the African Americans of Brooklyn are being incarcerated way up in the Adirondacks. And you find it's like our gulag upstate New York. And the same is true in California, where most of the inmates are coming from certain neighborhoods in Los Angeles and San Francisco and are being incarcerated throughout rural California. It's true in Michigan as well. So you have this economic incentive. So it's political, bureaucratic, and economic, but I would argue that this complex is also a psychological one. And in psychiatric terms, a complex is an overreaction to some perceived threat. And that's what we've done in the last 20 years. We have found a very simplistic, very blunt tool for dealing with profound social problems. And not only have we overreacted, but we just want them out of sight and out of mind. But there are huge, huge consequences of this. And one of the things I've tried to do in talking about the other books that I've written, and now I guess this is one of the first talks I've given about prisons, is just trying to pose the question, you know, well, why should you care? I mean, only one of us here has been in prison. Most of you will probably never go to prison, although maybe some of you will. But why should you care? So I'll try to tell you some reasons why you should care. Well, do you live in the USA? Do you pay taxes? You are connected to this system. You are paying for it, and you are part of it. So that's just a kind of a financial, selfish, but also moral and ethical argument. On a more practical level, there is this, I would argue, totally artificial distinction between the prison world and this mainstream straight world. I mean, the bars are there, and the razor wire is there. But if these inmates are out every 2.5 years, those walls aren't high enough, and that razor wire isn't sharp enough to protect you from these consequences. I mean, I can talk on and on about the gang culture that we have fostered in these prisons, about how the prisons are the ideal recruiting areas, not just for the traditional African-American gangs like the Bloods and the Crips or the Latino gangs, but also for Aryan supremacists, for neo-Nazi gangs. This is where the hatred and the anger is being bred and where the institutional structures are being formed. And so it's not like there's a prison world separate from you. This prison culture is now permeating our culture. And I would argue it's a totally natural reaction to the culture of punishment and control that built these buildings. When I spoke earlier about 1 out of every 3 young black men, 1 out of every 4 young black men being under control of the criminal justice system, this has profound consequences for an entire huge group of people in this country. Having a felony conviction, well, having any drug conviction will lose you your student loan. Let's say that. Having a felony conviction will prevent you from getting all kinds of professional certificates. So there are all kinds of jobs that you can't have, including running for office. It permanently limits your opportunity for economic advancement. And I don't think it should be any surprise that right now in the state of California, there are 4 times as many young black men in prison than at college. And we are spending more money in the United States right now on the capital costs of our prisons than of our universities. So this speaks very loudly to the future of this country and to an entire group of people who are being disenfranchised. And I mean literally disenfranchised. Right now in the United States, 1 out of every 8 African American men cannot vote, has lost the right to vote. And I mean, you know, there's no question that if those men had been allowed to vote, we would not have the president that we have right now. About 4 million Americans have lost the right to vote because of a felony conviction. And again, pardon me?
You can't vote if you're in prison.
You can't vote when you're in prison, and you can't vote after you're in prison. You lose the right to vote. And where are you from? Yeah, well, we are unique in this policy, and in some countries you can't vote while you're in prison, but once you're out, you can. So it's a form of internal exile. It's a form of creating a permanent second class of citizens, and it shouldn't be at all surprising to you that they are people of color, because we have had institutions to create second class citizens since the founding of this country. And our prison system is just the latest version of it. So, they're using drugs before they go in. They're using drugs while they're in. and then you let them out and you say that failing a urine test is grounds for going back into prison, what are the odds of them going back to prison? Very, very high. Now, I mean, in this book, Reefer Madness, I wrote about this hippie biker who got life without parole for his first marijuana offense. And after the Atlantic article I wrote came out, the sentence was reduced. It was reduced to 12 years, which is still, I mean, that's like, you know, that's an unbelievable sentence. Throughout his time in prison, he kept smoking pot. He likes smoking pot. He thinks there's nothing wrong with smoking pot. So he spent much of that 12 years in isolation in the hole. And he was very blunt that when he got out, he would keep smoking pot. So he's back in prison right now. But because he likes to smoke a joint, he has no history of opiate. Because he likes to smoke a joint, the American people will now have spent this year maybe $25,000 or $30,000 for his incarceration. Now, could that money have been better spent for him or for, you know, a million other people who need the money? I think so. So a lot of the system is designed to fail. Let's talk about the children of these inmates. Right now, one out of every 14 African-American children has a parent in prison. One out of every 14. And altogether, there are 2 million children in the United States who have at least one parent in prison. Now, what is one of the best predictors of whether a child will go to prison? If one of their parents was in prison. So we now have 2 million children at high risk of being incarcerated themselves. And again, predominantly African American and Latino. So this is a self-perpetuating system that has huge implications for the history and the future of this country. And as you look across the board at what's happening to civil rights in this country, to me, the prisons are an ideal symbol of what's happening in this country. Now, having spent time in these prisons and thought about prisons, I think as an institution, these are not very useful places. If you want to rehabilitate someone, if you want to help someone, locking them up behind bars isn't really a good idea. If someone is a danger to the community, separating them from the community makes sense. But as I think about this book on prisons, I'm ultimately thinking of the prison as a symbol. And to me, you can learn a great deal about a society, not by how the richest 1% live, but by how the society treats the poorest, weakest, most vulnerable, and mentally ill in its midst. And we are locking them up and brutalizing them. So the prison is a very apt symbol for me of America in the last 20 years. I don't think we need to reform our prisons so much as shut them down and reserve the few remaining ones for the people who just cannot function in our society. Kids behind bars. That's another great American innovation. And what's interesting is that juvenile corrections was really the last holdout in this country for the rehabilitative ideal, which was this notion was that they're kids, and whatever they've done, there's still a chance to encourage them to follow a different path. And that's vanishing too. So the whole notion of punishment is being introduced into children's prisons in a way that, you know, you haven't seen since the 19th century in this country. I don't know that I'm going to talk to victims' rights groups, but I'm a really big supporter of the victims' rights movement, and I did a big investigative piece for The Atlantic on how family members of homicide victims are treated by the criminal justice system, and really looked at the victims' rights movement. And I support the victims' rights amendment to the Constitution. What I'm going to look at is the whole notion of restorative justice. And restorative justice is a movement to connect the victims with crimes with their offenders and remove the whole notion of punishment from being under the control of the state. If you look at the whole early notions of justice, the victim and the offender were linked, and that's how you got all kinds of clan rivalries and blood libel, etc. And as the state got bigger, the state assumed control over punishment, so much so that victims got shut out of the process. So the notion of restorative justice is to kind of use formal institutional ways to reconnect the person who was really hurt with a person who hurt them in a direct way. I have found in my visits to prisons that the correctional authorities do not fit the typical left liberal stereotype of the big bad man sadistically incarcerating inmates. In a lot of ways, the much more accurate analogy is the Vietnam War. And the wardens and assistant wardens that I've met are not proud of locking up paranoid schizophrenics who don't have their medication and are wandering around talking to themselves. They derive a sense of self-worth from locking up, you know, murderers, etc. A lot of people on the left have stigmatized correctional officers in a way that is unfair. These are basically working-class people who are often taking the job because it's the best-paying job in their community. You know, one of the unions that has been the most stigmatized is the California Correctional Peace Officers Association, the California Correctional Officers. And I disagree with them politically enormously. And they are very conservative politically, but I've spent time with them, and I really understand how their views were formed, and I have respect for them because they are dealing with inmates in facilities that are at 200% of capacity. They are dealing with inmates without any sense of the community they came from, and they're seeing some horrible, horrible behavior. You know, I support unions, and this correctional officer union has really, you know, opened itself up to people of color and to women. So in talking to them, they represent the parole agents too, parole officers too. So it's not going to cost correctional officers jobs if they become parole officers instead. And you got to keep in mind that they are locked up in these prisons every day too. And it's a very dangerous, very scary, very stressful job. To change this system, you know, there's no room for being morally pure or self-righteous. And I think there are a lot of natural allies among groups who have firsthand experience of the system. When you go into these prisons, it's extraordinary how many dysfunctional people we have created. But other societies have found other ways to deal with people who don't fit and try to help them, as opposed to punishing them and brutalizing them. So I would say that the $40 billion a year we're spending is nothing compared to the real cost of this system, the real price that we're going to pay, and the price that we're all going to pay in the future. And it doesn't matter how wealthy or how privileged you are. If this system continues, you're going to pay. And that's my prison talk.
That was Eric Schlosser, author of the bestseller Fast Food Nation, discussing his research on the American prison system for a compendium for the Atlantic Monthly.
Our next guest is Chicago attorney Michael Deutsch, who is right now in the middle of defending Mohamed Salah. For listeners to our past shows, you know that Salah, a Chicago businessman with five children, left and brought money over to the Holy Land for charitable purposes, was caught by the Israelis, tortured for 53 days, forced to sign a confession after the torture. That confession was used against him. He did 5 years in prison in Israel. When he came back to his family in Chicago, years passed, Bush got elected, 9/11 happened, Ashcroft indicted Salah, and he's now on trial in Chicago in one of these show trial terrorism cases, just like we had with the Lynn Stewart case.
Michael Deutsch, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
You've been on trial for how many weeks now?
We started with jury selection October 12th.
Bring us up to date now as to where the trial's at.
The government has put on about 9-10 weeks of testimony. Of course, a lot of it as to Mr. Salah revolves around the confession, and without that confession, alleged confession, they really wouldn't have a case at all.
Remind the listeners, Michael, a little bit about the confession.
Okay, he was interrogated intensively for 54 days. He was kept incommunicado for 6 days. He had like a 15-minute interview with the U.S. consulate after 6 days. They had hidden him from the U.S. consulate. He didn't get to see a lawyer for 15 days. For the first 48 to 72 hours, he had almost no sleep. He was either intensively interrogated throughout the day and night or put in a position called waiting, which is a term of art that the Israelis use, which is where you're tied to a tiny chair with your hands behind your back with a smelly hood on you. You wait there until they're ready to interrogate you again. So it's a way to keep you up and prevent you from sleeping.
When I was in the territories, I saw those chairs and those hoods, and it's this chair that once you're in it, your body, and once you're forced to sit in it for a while, your body comes into excruciating pain. And these burlap-type sacks are filled with either rotten-smelling things, from rotten eggs to, you know, feces to whatever, and placed over people's heads, and so it's just unbearable.
Yeah, and we had testimony in the suppression hearing from a person that said that was the worst experience. It's like suffocating. It's hard to breathe, and you're constantly smelling that, either vomit or some other, you know, disgusting material.
So what are the charges against him, and how did the government attempt to make out its case?
Essentially, the charge against him is that he was part of what they call a racketeering enterprise under RICO, which they claim Hamas is a racketeering enterprise. Of course, that was not the natural definition. We say Hamas, whether you agree with it or disagree with it, is a large political movement which has many different aspects and a lot of different goals and strategies. They're saying that Hamas is a criminal enterprise, and under RICO, the Racketeering Influence Corrupt Organization Act, he, by bringing money in 1993, this is before Hamas was even designated by the United States government as a terrorist organization, which wasn't until 95, and made it illegal to do business with Hamas or provide material support for Hamas. This is prior to that. In 93, he brought money, and the government claims by bringing money and giving money to what they claim was part of the military wing of Hamas, he was a member of the conspiracy.
One of the aspects of the case which I thought was fascinating, that just like a bad penny keeps turning up, Judy Miller turned up in this case, and you got to cross-examine her. Tell us why the government put Judy Miller on and the exchange that you had with the erstwhile ex-New York Times reporter.
Let me say a word about Judy Miller first. It's Judith Miller. She was the front-page writer for the New York Times on how Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Eventually, the Times was forced into basically making an apology for seven or so articles, or maybe less, but around that number, that Judith Miller wrote, and she is no longer working at the New York Times.
And I do have to say that one of our listeners contacted me and said, you know, I worked with Judy Miller at the Times, and boy, did she hate Muslims.
Really?
Well,
yes.
She wrote a book called God Has 99 Names, which clearly lays that out, and Edward Said wrote an incredible article critiquing her book and showing that she knew nothing and she was totally prejudiced.
So her lying about weapons of mass destruction to a broad audience wasn't her first foray into trying to influence American policy in the Middle East through her so-called reporting.
No, this is her modus operandi. She has these close personal relationships with government officials, and in return for this access, she agrees to put out what propaganda they want put out. And she did this way back in 93. And again, you know, she did it around the Iraq war.
We're speaking with Michael Deutsch, a lead counsel in the Mohammed Salah case that's going on right now in Chicago in federal court.
One of the other, I think, important points is they put on this lawyer who was one of the lawyers in the civil case around the interrogatories. And it turns out he admits he was a neighbor of Nathan Lewin, and Nathan Lewin organized him to be part of the lawsuit. And then he kind of admits the civil lawsuit was a test case, and it was a design to bankrupt all the Palestinian Muslim organizations in the U.S. That was the purpose of it. And I said, well, didn't you know these organizations were involved in First Amendment activity? They were educating people about what was going on under occupation. Didn't that trouble you to close them down? No, we didn't care about that. We wanted to close them down. And then he went into the objections to the interrogatories. Here's an example of one interrogatory. Tell us every meeting or event you went to that concerned Palestinian causes and the names of every person that was at that event.
This is a question that was asked Salah in an interrogatory. Right?
That's unbelievable.
The lawyer said it's overbroad and vague and violates the First Amendment, but, you know, I'll answer it over objection. And this is what they're basing this obstruction of justice count on, the fact that his interrogatories are not true.
Michael Deutsch, lead counsel for Mohammed Salah in the case that's going on now in Chicago. If you had to sum up in five sentences to the jury on what they're trying to get away with here, what would you say?
I think this is a politically motivated case. They're accusing a political movement with many diverse elements as a racketeering enterprise. It's not a racketeering enterprise. That Salah's motivation was to help the people who are suffering under extreme, terrible conditions caused by the Israelis, and that he had no intent to further any criminal activity. And in fact, the case is old and stale, and there's no evidence that he had any involvement with anything when he got out of prison for 7 years. There's no evidence of any activity in support of Hamas.
We'll stay in touch with you for frequent updates on your trial.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, you're a wonderful attorney and inspiration, really, to everyone fighting for social justice and fighting torture in America. We'd like to remind listeners that we've interviewed Michael Deutsch throughout this trial and even before, and you can listen to him if you go to our website at lawanddisorder.org, input Michael Deutsch in the search engine, and it will pull up all of his past interviews, and you can listen to this from beginning to end.
Thank you so much.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. This month, we mark the 53rd execution in the United States this year. It happened in Florida with all the hallmarks of why we think the death penalty should be abolished. We're joined today by Kristen Houlet, an associate with the Program to Abolish the Death Penalty at Amnesty International, to speak with us about the execution of Angel Diaz. Welcome, Kristen, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Dahlia. It's great to be here.
Kristen, tell us about the case of Angel Diaz. What happened?
Well, as you said, this case represents all of the failures of the death penalty system, particularly in the state of Florida. Angel Diaz was sentenced to death largely on the basis of the testimony of a jailhouse snitch who later recanted and said that he actually knew nothing about the case. Mr. Diaz was also subject to the fact that Florida is the only state in the country which does not require juries to be unanimous when sentencing someone to death, and the jury had voted 8-4. You know, it's likely that if they had known that this person, this jailhouse snitch, was lying or that there was a significant doubt about his testimony, even more people would have had reservations about sentencing Mr. Diaz to death.
How many years ago was he sentenced?
1985.
So four people on the jury of 12 did not want to give him the death penalty.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
I know they tortured him when they killed him, but people are going to say, well, he's a murderer. And so they hurt him a little bit. They're just giving back what he dished out. But that's really not the question, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, the state of Florida has already come under scrutiny by the U.S. Supreme Court earlier this year when it heard whether or not a man by the name of Clarence Hill could challenge lethal injection as cruel and unusual punishment and as a violation of civil rights. The court ruled unanimously in Clarence Hill's favor and ordered the courts of Florida to review lethal injection. They pretty much refused, and Mr. Hill was executed in Florida, setting off four executions to take place just in the last few months alone.
What happened in this execution?
This execution took much, much longer than normal to proceed, and they ended up administering two doses of the drugs to Mr. Diaz. It appeared that he was grimacing in pain, gasping for breath, and that he was, if not fully conscious, at least aware of what was going on for much of the process.
Kristen, most of us don't know what normally happens during an execution of this kind. Can you tell us, if it runs as they expect it to run, what happens?
Well, the first drug that is administered is a barbiturate. It's meant to act as an anesthetic and basically knock them out. And then the second drug is a paralytic agent, so it paralyzes all of the muscles. And then the third drug, potassium chloride, stops the heart. The problem is if the first drug is not administered in proper doses, then second drug paralyzes a person to the point that they could not actually let the execution team know what's going on with them.
How long does the state say it's supposed to take?
Well, I don't know if they even have that written down, but most executions seem to take 15 minutes or less. And this one took 34 minutes. And again, you know, it was unusual in the fact that they had to administer two doses of each drug.
Do they have a doctor in the room?
It appeared that they had some men come in at towards the end of the process. They were hooded, and so nobody knows who they are.
They were hooded? That's incredible.
It's really medieval.
Now, someone told me that doctors refused to go in and do this. Is that right?
Well, medical ethics prohibit physicians from participating in the execution other than to pronounce death, and that has been another large piece of the lethal injection challenges that have arisen throughout the country over the past year.
Is that why the hood?
Yes, it's to protect their confidence.
Kristen, one thing that bothers me, though, I hope that people don't conclude from this that they should just do it right and continue executing people.
Right. Amnesty International contends that there is no humane way to execute a human being and that the money that is being invested in tinkering with the process would be better directed towards actual crime prevention measures or drug treatment programs, mental health services, and meaningful victim services.
Let me ask you, when they put the drugs in, it's not a doctor who puts the drugs in, right?
Right.
And the person who puts the drugs in, I guess by a hypodermic needle or a needle, isn't hooded.
No.
That person is not hooded.
No, they're not hooded.
It's really these guys who come in later.
Right.
Stan Tookie Williams out in California was executed the same way. They didn't put in the lines right, and they tortured him the same way they tortured Angel. How many states have
lethal injection?
Lethal injection. How many states have that?
37 out of 38 states. We have received word that Florida Governor Jeb Bush has issued an executive order creating a commission on administration of lethal injection, which will conduct an independent review of the state's lethal injection protocols.
Wow.
The creation of this commission essentially puts a halt on all executions in Florida until the committee members have had a chance to analyze the lethal injection protocol and issue recommendations.
Now, if people want to find out more, do something about it, is there a website and some actions people can take?
people contact the Amnesty International coordinator in Florida, Mark Elliott. They can visit the website of Floridians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. Their website address is fadp.org.
We'll put all that up on our website, lawanddisorder.org. Kristen Houlet of Amnesty International, thank you very much for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Dahlia.
Amnesty International issued a press release after Jeb Bush temporarily halted the executions in Florida. And the last part of the press release is worth considering. Amnesty writes, "While we welcome the creation of this body as a step in the right direction, the problem that plagued Florida's death penalty system transcends issues surrounding the current lethal injection debacle. The inherent risk of executing the innocent, the biased and arbitrary nature by which the death penalty is administered at all levels, and the lack of demonstrable evidence that the death penalty has a unique deterrent effect on crime demonstrates that the death penalty is irreparably flawed. Instead of tinkering with the machinery of death, Florida should focus its resources on effective crime prevention measures and abolish the death penalty once and for all."
Those who may regard lynching as a shameful part of the past need only read the book From Lynch Mobs to the Killing State, edited by Austin Surratt and Charles Ogletree, to realize that state-sanctioned executions are sanitized forms of lynching justified by society. Professors Ogletree and Surratt have assembled lucid and intelligent work in which essays from sociologists, historians, criminologists, and lawyers weave together a social history that starkly reveals how this country's death penalty is rooted in lynchings. Racism informs both kinds of killings. The 985 lives lost to official lynchings in the United States since the practice resumed in 1976 symbolize, according to one of the book's contributors, a much broader and enduring culture of American apartheid. We're delighted to welcome Austin Surratt to the show today. He is the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Jurisprudence and Political Science at Amherst College. His books include Mercy on Trial, What It Means to Stop an Execution. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Professor Surratt.
Thanks for having me.
We've read your book and its fabulous compendium of articles on the death penalty. Could you tell us briefly about one of the central themes, namely, how has the death penalty in this country evolved from lynching?
Well, let me just say a couple of things about that. First of all, many people think about lynching as kind of completely lawless and chaotic. Lynching was not completely lawless and chaotic. It had its own kind of normative basis, its own rules, not surprisingly socially organized. And of course, the victims of lynching, not exclusively, but predominantly, and the victims of lynching in the South were African Americans. The death penalty today is applied in ways that are racially discriminatory. And many scholars believe that the way in which the death penalty is applied in this racially discriminatory way is a more socially acceptable and now, of course, state-sanctioned form of lynching behavior. There is evidence. A scholar at the University of California named Franklin Zimmering has produced evidence that states which have a high rate of execution in the United States today, and they are predominantly southern states like Texas and Virginia, were states that had high rates of lynching. And that evidence, that states that execute today and states that lynched in the past, quite obviously people think linked to histories of the effort to create structures of racial subordination.
We're speaking with Austin Surratt, who has written From Lynch Mobs to the Killing State. I don't think people understand just the horrific dimension of lynchings. I read in your book that it was kind of an official system of terrorizing people, and that before they kind of slowly ground to a halt, 5,000 people were killed.
It was quite a phenomenon in the United States, and again, predominantly in the South. And there was a kind of is a kind of analog to lynching. Of course, that was public executions. So you had side-by-side lynching, and you had side-by-side to that executions which were state-sanctioned and in which there had been a formal adjudication of guilt and a formal application of penalty, which were also public spectacles. There was no shame about lynching. There are these very famous photographs of people at lynchings, and they're smiling to the cameras and waving.
They're wearing suits and ties and straw hats. It's like a picnic.
Absolutely,
I couldn't believe
right.
it.
Absolutely right. It was a form of a public spectacle, a form of both the creation of a kind of community solidarity and also the creation of the deviant outside other. And it was a way of marking a racial boundary and reinforcing a racial hierarchy.
There are some fascinating essays in this book. I wanted to just let our listeners know, if you would, what led to the temporary abolition of the death penalty in 1972 with the Furman v. Georgia decision, just to put everything in context for some of the theses that are presented after.
Sure. In 1972, the United States Supreme Court, in the Furman case that you just referred, suspended the application of the death penalty. It, in fact, ruled that the death penalty, as then applied, was a form of cruel and unusual punishment. It really focused on a couple of things. The court was concerned with the arbitrariness and capricious fashion in which the death penalty was then applied. And as a subset of that, the court was concerned with the extent to which, in this arbitrary and capricious system of capital punishment that the United States was employing in the middle of the 20th century, that the arbitrariness was focused particularly on race. And in order to make that comprehensible, I just have to say the following. The statutes, the laws that govern the death penalty that Furman struck down, that Furman invalidated, were laws that left the question of who lived and who died, who got the death penalty and who did not, totally to the discretion of the jury. So these laws, in essence, said any murderer may get the death penalty. And the question of which murderer did get the death penalty was left totally to the discretion of the jury. And Justice Douglas, in one of the central opinions in Furman, said such discretion, such open-ended discretion, is pregnant with discrimination. So the court was worried about the extent to which the discretion of juries would be used in ways that were arbitrary and discriminatory.
You have a section that addresses how the issue of race is undeniably a divisive one and discomforting in public discourse. And you cite that there's both continuity and change in the role that race plays in the new abolition's public rhetoric, notably over the past 30 years, from Furman decision to the wonderful mass commutation that took place in Illinois recently.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about this and your thoughts on, can race compete as an issue of public discourse with science and the DNA
right.
evidence?
I think we're in a period of national reconsideration of capital punishment. Where the United States is on the issue of capital punishment in 2006 would have been almost unimaginable 20 years ago. And there's lots of evidence of this national reconsideration of capital punishment. For example, 5 or 6 years ago, 300 people across the country were sentenced to death. In 2005, that number had been cut to 125. So more than a 50% drop in the number of people being sentenced to death across the United States. Again, go back 5 or 6 years, 98 people were executed, where the sentence was actually carried out. This last year, in 2006 rather, the number is 53. So again, a cut of maybe 40% in the number of people who've been executed. That suggests that the appetite for capital punishment is by no means as strong as it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago.
How do you explain that?
I believe that the reason for that is what I've called in the work that I've done, the new abolitionism. 10 or 20 years ago, abolitionist position was very much about the person who was going to be executed, that it would violate their human dignity, that it was a form of revenge, that we should be compassionate and understanding for the people who had committed these horrible crimes. And those arguments had absolutely no political traction. They changed very few minds. More recently, abolitionists are not focusing on those abstract, let's call them moral and philosophical issues. They're focusing on the day-to-day administration of capital punishment. So now the argument is, you can be in favor of the death penalty in the abstract, but be against executing people who might be innocent. You can be in favor of the death penalty in the abstract, but be against executing people because they had bad lawyers. You can be in favor of the death penalty in the abstract and be against executing people because of the race of their victim. And I think this change, this period of national reconsideration, has been fueled by this more practical, more implementation-oriented abolitionism. And the central factor in this new abolitionism is the concern about innocence, is the phenomenon of seeing people who were tried, convicted, who went through the appellate process, subsequently exonerated from death row. That's the most important factor in the new abolitionism. That unites people. Conversation about race requires people often to be concerned about people who seem not to be like them.
Don't you also say that the new abolitionists must resist that temptation to further marginalize the discourse of race?
I do. In fact, what I say is that there's a kind of, let's say, moral and political dilemma that new abolitionists face, and that is whether they will efface the conversation about race, whether they will mute the conversation about race, whether they will marginalize the conversation about race in favor of this focus on innocence and error because of the political mileage and capital that they can get from focusing on DNA and error.
We're speaking with Austin Surratt, who's a professor at Amherst College. He's just written From Lynch Mobs to the Killing State, Race and the Death Penalty in America. Professor, I wanted to ask you what your personal opinion is as to whether or not you're against the death penalty or just against its unfair administration.
I believe the death penalty in the United States is antithetical to American values. I believe the death penalty in the United States is destructive of democratic concerns. I believe the death penalty in the United States is an assault upon values, equal protection under the law, due process, fairness, rationality in the administration of criminal justice. But I think the most powerful arguments against the death penalty begin not from an abstract conversation. That's fine for philosophers, and that may be fine for theologians, but if you want to do something about capital punishment in the United States, you have to examine the way in which it is administered. So I associate myself with this position that I've described as new abolitionism, and frankly, I think that the new abolitionism is what has produced the decline that I talked about before and will convince Americans over time that the death penalty may be fine in the abstract, but that we cannot afford to live with it in its implementation and its administration and still respect these central American values.
Do you have any opinions about why our criminal justice system in the United States fails to counteract sort of age-old discriminatory impulses toward racism?
Yeah. It's gotten harder to counteract those age-old discriminatory impulses, in part because of the success or the prominence of the anti-discrimination ethic in the United States. So it's no longer, I think, acceptable in most places in the United States to express overt racist attitudes. So discrimination has been driven underground. It's more subtle, it's more institutional, it's more structural. And therefore the challenge of dealing with the kinds of racial discrimination that affect the death penalty, which is primarily about African Americans, the challenge of dealing with these issues of discrimination is much more difficult because they're much more subtle. The legal system is not going to be much better than the people who administer it. The legal system is not going to be much better than the people who sit in juries and decide who gets the death penalty. And where there is discrimination or prejudice in the hearts and souls and spirits and minds of people when they go into a jury room, there's going to be discrimination in the results of their verdicts.
And part of the problem with our system is that we don't have an integrated judicial system, that so often the jurors are white and have perhaps subconscious biases toward African Americans. Especially one point in the book mentioned in the system the fact that a lot of the capital cases involve violence and may perpetuate racial stereotypes.
If you were a citizen of Massachusetts, as I am, and you watched the last gubernatorial campaign completed in November, in which an African American candidate became the governor of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick, and you watched the campaign run by his opponent, Carrie Healey, a Republican lieutenant governor seeking to become governor of Massachusetts, you lived through again the Willie Horton conversation of 1988. She tried to run against him as being weak on crime, soft on crime.
Remind our listeners about what the specter of Willie Horton meant.
Sure,
back
in 1988, when Michael Dukakis ran for president, as a Democrat, also a governor of Massachusetts, the Republican candidate, George H.W. Bush, ran a series of commercials featuring a program in Massachusetts that allowed convicted murderers to be released after having served a substantial parts of their sentence. One of these people was named Willie Horton. He subsequently, after his release, murdered someone else. And Willie Horton became the symbol of Michael Dukakis' permissiveness, of his soft-on-crime attitude. Of course, George H.W. Bush did not inform people in these commercials that Ronald Reagan, when he was governor of California, had approved a very similar release program.
So you're saying that this kind of dirty scare, fear tactics was used most recently in the Massachusetts gubernatorial race?
I'm saying that one of the ways in which we talk about race today is we never mention the word race. We talk about crime and criminality. To be soft on crime,
yeah, it's a code word.
Is a code for a whole set of associations so that the conversation about race can be very indirect.
I'm totally with you, and I'm grateful that you did this book, because I think that it's so well done. It's an effective book. I would say this, that I would also not only appeal to American sense of fairness in the new way that you have been arguing. We as a country are bigger than imposing the death penalty on anybody. To allow for that is really society has matured past that point. I would add that to a discussion if I had one privately with somebody about why I'm opposed. And I've come to the position I'm opposed to the death penalty here and everywhere else. As a practical matter, it's counterproductive. I don't think it deters crime. It hardens and kind of calcifies the kind of morality that people have if it's legal in this country. And I wanted your reaction to that kind of position.
Well, again, I respect that kind of position, and I don't disagree with it. My concern is to analyze the death penalty coolly and analytically. My concern is to identify in the most practical ways places where the death penalty fails. My concern is to reach out to people who disagree with my position on capital punishment to try to find common ground, to come to a point at which the United States can say we no longer need to live with the death penalty. And I've reached the conclusion that arguments that appeal to abstract philosophical and moral notions may be very satisfying to the people who make them, but they very seldom change anyone's mind. And so if you want to end capital punishment, if you want to reach the point at which the United States no longer uses the death penalty, I believe that the most effective way of reaching that point is to examine not the abstract and philosophical questions, but the ways in which, in every day, in every way, the death penalty is an assault on values and commitments that we as citizens of the United States hold dear.
Professor Surratt, I would just like to remind our listeners, From Lynch Mobs to the Killing State, it's published by New York University Press and edited by Austin Surratt and Charles Ogletree. And we highly recommend that everyone read this book. It has been an honor to have you on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thanks very much for having me.
Law and Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black body swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant South, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree to drop. Here's a strange and bitter.